The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Boot computer, list of today's guests, signing in chat room, lining up news articles, checking level, adjusting camera, secure wire connection, restart computer, checking video feed.
With all she's got to do, you'd think Nicole Sandler was a one-woman band. Well, she is, and she's ready for another show. And now, here's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com.
All right, welcome to a Wednesday. It is the day before the season finale of the January 6th hearings. You know, they've made it clear today that this will not be the final hearing, but we'll get more into that as we go along. Today on the show, we got a busy, busy show today. Digby will be here at the bottom of the hour. You know, when Digby and I get together, we always have long philosophical discussions, and there's plenty to talk about today. But we're going to start the show today with another of the candidates that I get to choose from here in Florida's newly drawn 23rd congressional district, because, you know, they keep messing with them. Ted Deutch, my current congressman, is not running for re-election, so it is an open seat. And what I've done is I've invited all six of the candidates vying for the Democratic nomination to join me on the show. So we not only I get to know them, but you do too, because an informed electorate is one who gets out and votes. So if you're not in Florida's 23rd, and I know most people listening are not, I encourage you, if you still have time before your primary, to get to know who your candidates are. Because this is one of the most important choices we have. And honestly, as a nation, we've kind of screwed it up pretty badly. So let's get it right this time, okay? So please join me in welcoming today's candidate, I'm going to mess up your name, Hava Holzhauer. Is that right?
You know what? You got it.
Oh, there you go. Well, Hava Holzhauer is the only woman running for the seat. So thank you for stepping up and doing that. Tell us a little bit about yourself. You have not held elected office before, have you?
Well, if you count high school, I have.
Okay.
I was treasurer of my senior class and president in eighth grade. But that being said, no, I have not held elected office in an official capacity since that time. But it is time for me to do so. I have been fighting for our rights in this community for 20-ish years, and longer than that if you put all the time together since I graduated from law school. I started as a civil rights and workers' rights attorney. A lot of the work, or some of the highlights from that time, were discrimination cases against, supporting people who have been discriminated against based on race, based on age, based on pregnancy. It was also the time that the Family Medical Leave Act first came to be. And so the rollout of the Family Medical Leave Act, which is still not strong enough and good enough, but it was a great first step, especially being a woman working in a man's world, having, you know, being 5 months pregnant when I graduated from law school. So that was actually a personal issue right off the bat that I needed childcare. And so having the ability to stay home and not lose my job was an actually very exciting and important first step. And also during that time, I worked for businesses to help them stay out of court, to create policies and procedures to do right by their staff and employees, so that we can all do the good work together.
Right.
And so that was sort of the first piece.
Now, have you been involved in the Broward County or are you in Palm Beach County? Are you?
I've been in Palm Beach County since 2004. I grew up in Chicago. I was born in D.C.
Okay.
And, I was a prosecutor, an assistant state attorney in the 15th Judicial Circuit, which is in Palm Beach County. And during that time, I spent a lot of time in juvenile, working on some of the highlights from that time, alternatives to delinquency. So in that process, which was part the reality of my job and part volunteer time, I worked across sectors because it's sort of a collaborative space of trying to find justice in a system that is fraught with injustice, especially for our young people. So I certainly was out in the community at that time. And then another piece of my job, in 2013, I shifted gears from the strict practice of law, and I was tapped to run the Anti-Defamation League statewide in Florida.
Right.
Which is, it's a civil rights organization with a focus and an expertise on anti-Semitism, but also an application of standing up for all isms and fighting hatred and bigotry and prejudice and stereotypes. And so for me, actually, that was a big shift, because instead of the strict practice of law, it became using a different toolbox, right? An expanded toolbox to fight injustice. And mm-hmm. so it was education and incident handling and community collaboration and working again across sectors and with people who see the world through very different lenses. So I am getting around to your question, which was okay. Certainly in my time at the ADL, that was a statewide position. And so I spent a lot of time all over South Florida, in Miami and in Broward, working with my board members, working with partners on the ground, handling incidents in our communities that happened at places of worship, in neighborhoods, everywhere. So,
gotcha. But the part I was asking is if you're a member of like the Broward or the Palm Beach County DEC, or if you're involved in the local, you know, political machine is what I'm asking, or if you're just an outsider.
I am absolutely not involved in the political machine, as you describe it. You know, I haven't been involved in party politics. I have volunteered, you know, throughout the years for different friends who have campaigned or people who inspired me. I have, you know, participated and gone to certain club meetings over the years that might have had a topic that was part of my work. I certainly involved a lot of our legislators and government officials in my work, inviting them to be on panels, to speak to the public, you know, to engage in problem solving. One example I can think of that was right after the terrible tragedy in Parkland mm-hmm. that we're watching play out a bit again on the news right now through the sentencing hearing. I brought together, you know, a bunch of thought leaders and community members and decision makers to share information in a little group I formed called the Get It Done Group, so that we could, you know, not duplicate efforts, but teach one another what we know. And in that time, I had some of our, you know, legislators there and, you know, done a lot of work in the community with the people who are, you know, doing the work of serving and doing the work of trying to make our community better.
Got it. So what made you decide to bite the bullet and jump in? When was there a light bulb moment that happened, or was there one specific incident? What was it?
It really was a light bulb moment. The moment that Ted Deutch actually announced it publicly mm-hmm. Is when the light bulb went off for me. I've been doing the work of fighting the justice for justice in our community. It's who I am. I'm an advocate. Not everybody, you know, is an outward advocate, but it is something, you know, I think I got from my parents and a little bit maybe from, you know, my Jewish identity. But, you know, when I was growing up, I didn't get to sleep in on Sunday mornings like my kids always did. I was, you know, dragged to by my parents to help with some, you know, social justice effort, either at a, you know, delivering food or working some, you know, taking somebody else's job, you know, on Christmas, for example, so that they could go home, or participating and volunteering in the hospitals where my dad worked. And anyway, it's just been who I am for so long. And when I looked at the state of Florida and the state of this country, and we're going backwards. Yeah. We are reversing progress in terms of justice, in terms of fundamental freedoms, in terms of, you know, caring about one another and lifting each other up. And when I think about our country, we live in a time of abundance as Americans. Mm-hmm. We have abundant financial resources. We have abundant human capital. We have it all here, but we are not getting it done. We're not using it wisely, and we're hurting people. So, you know, it's obvious when you look at the state of Florida, the challenges we have that are related to education, the challenges related to climate, the challenges related to housing and our seniors. But what is layered now on top of that, that makes all of that, which is so important, very hard to even get to, is the marginalization of so many communities, of women, of the LGBTQ community, of, you know, disabled persons, of the list goes on and on. In our state, our governor is picking, I feel like I'm in seventh grade again. Uh-huh. Remember how there'd be like a mean girl who was like, picked somebody else every 2 weeks who was going to be their, you know, their victim. That's what goes on in the state of Florida. And then at the federal level, it's really the only place that we can start to build a fence around some of these civil rights and freedoms that have been neglected and regressing for so long. So this is my skill set for 20 years. There's nobody in this race that has it. And it is the primary work that needs to be done in our country to properly put justice at the center of the way we operate in every other decision that we make. It's not there. It's going backwards. And so I'm going to Washington to put it there.
I hear you. Now, you have young children, too, right? So I got to, you know, my daughter has grown. She's now 23. And I've never been happier that she's out of school because of what's going on. We have a crazy governor. And I don't know if you saw the editorial today in the Sun Sentinel. I'm going to share it. I already shared it on social media today. It's about Ron DeSantis and the fact that maybe Donald Trump's influence is waning a little bit. That's good news, but the bad news is it's boosting Ron DeSantis, who I see as the most dangerous politician in America today. Is part of your desire to run, does it have anything to do with him?
Well, it absolutely has to do with what he's done to this state. All right. Like, we've been red for a long time, but this is next level, as my kids would say. You asked me about my kids. They're not so young anymore, but they're still young. I have four of them, and they're between the ages of 17 and 23. Oh. So, you know, when I think about my kids, a lot of people talk about the next generation and the next generation dealing with climate and the next generation. I don't want to leave it for the next generation. My kids are, all four of them, in that age break bracket where the number one reason in this country that youth of that age die is by bullet. It's not by automobile. It is not by, you know, some kind of a health disaster. That's what it is. It is the epidemic of guns. So I am not going to leave it, you know, to our children to be responsible for the mess that we put it in. So circling back to your second part of your question and the governor, when I see the policies that have been created, and one of the most, you know, common talked about is the don't say gay policy, or the one that was very recent that he's considering, you know, criminalizing adults who take children to drag shows. a lot of us are going to be in jail, by the way, if that's the case. And I'm joking, but it's not funny. You know that it's sinister, and you know it's not based in reality, because he's creating a hurtful law that has nothing to do with what's actually happening in schools.
Nothing at all. No, he's a vindictive, horrible, you know, authoritarian figure who should not be the governor, let alone the president. So have a whole sour. I need to apologize to you because I'm having trouble with my Chiron here. And I do this all myself. So I screwed it up and then I screwed up and I wrote your name wrong on there. It's Hava Holzhauer. I will make sure Holzhauer. Holzhauer. Sorry, yes. I got it right at the beginning and I screw it up now. Figures. But I will get it right on the blog, and when I post the video, I'll make sure all your information is there and it's correct.
Thank you.
So your website is pretty comprehensive. You know, I always can tell the sign of a good progressive because you write out the issues and you say where you stand on them. We can tell when somebody is more conservative, or they, you know, because they don't want to tell you where they stand on the issues. So you do start with common sense. You have common sense gun policies in there. Mm-hmm. And you did mention we're reliving the Parkland shooting. The rest of the nation may not know this because there are three of these shooters in court around the country for one thing or another this week, there or in the public eye, Uvalde and Buffalo. And of course, here in Parkland, the shooter, whose name I don't say, by the way, he pleaded guilty, but now they're having the penalty phase. And the penalty phase is a full-blown trial that they say is going to take 4 to 6 months, which is mind-blowing. And they're going through every aspect of it. And today they've got kids who survived the shooting who are reliving the experience. And it's horrific. We shouldn't be in this position. I live in Coral Springs. My daughter actually went to Coral Glades, but she was in a program called, at the very end as she was graduating, because she wasn't a great student, off-campus learning center, and where she was able to get her final credits done and graduate. Well, and it's where they send the trouble kids. And sure enough, the day after the shooting, when they put the shooter's picture on the TV, my daughter looked up and said, "Oh my God, I know him. He was in my OCLC class. He sat right down the row from me." And if I tell you, my stomach dropped. There are no words to describe the feeling you get when you know your daughter was in the proximity of one of these sorry excuses for a human being. But I'm curious, because you say common sense gun policies, but it seems like you stopped short of a calling for an assault weapons ban. Would you be in favor of that?
100%. 100%. I wrote an article that was in the Sun Sentinel right the same night of the shooting. And for one moment, I just want to say, backing up, and then I'll move forward with your question. I was thinking as I was watching, you know, the coverage of the sentencing hearing and the length of it that you just described, it's going to be the injustice of having to have the families go through this again, because that's how our legal system works. And, you know, that is just one of many things that are, you know, so problematic about the world we live in. But in terms of assault weapon ban, absolutely. I wrote this article and the title was something like throw everything at it, including the kitchen sink, right? That expression. And that is really what needs to be done. You know, I am a person that I would rather be smart than right. And what I mean by I would rather be smart than right is that I will take every single piece of legislation that we can build, like building a fence of armor around, you know, this problem, this gun epidemic that is killing our country, literally.
Right.
Until it is strong enough, you know, that it makes a dent. And every piece where we can save one life is worth it.
Oh.
But we're going to need to make, you know, layers and layers and layers to get it done. But an assault weapon ban would certainly be a tremendously important piece of the puzzle.
It would be a good start, wouldn't it? It seems like we're certainly not doing it. Oh, and now.
Look at that. Fancy.
So I've been trying to fix it this whole time, and now... Now it's coming up 20 times because there's no rhyme or reason with this program that I use. Anyway, I think I finally, okay, this will work. Maybe. See, I had it and then it goes away.
You did.
All
I
right.
Saw
I'm
it.
So, you know, I there's something that's not right here. Anyway, Hava Holzhauer is with us. She is running for Congress from Florida's 23rd congressional district. And I wish you the best of luck. It's a tough.
Thank
have
you.
There been any debates among the candidates here, or will there be?
There have been a few debates. There are six of us in the race, five guys and myself. Two of the guys have been in elected office and have a lot more money than I do.
Yeah.
But we have what we need, and we're still working on it, and we're doing really well. There have been several debates. There was one that was held by the statewide LGBTQ caucus, and it was hosted at the Pride Center. And I think the Dolphin Democrats hosted the event itself. And three of us were in that. It was myself and two of the guys. Just call them the guys. And you know, people want to know their names, they can look them up.
But, yeah, not the main guys. I'll tell you something. You know, I decided that at least I've got your logo up there. that I was going to invite everybody. And your campaign, yours was, I got to say, the most professional. You weren't the fastest, but the most professional. You actually had somebody, you know, email me back and respond and, you know, and engage, which was wonderful. The front runner, who I will not name, though I have on social media, is the only one, the only campaign that has not responded to me. And I just find that, you know, sad. Because he thinks he's a shoo-in, and he may not be. And my problem with him is that, I don't know, he worked too closely with this administration in Tallahassee. And I think there is a need to work with the other side. I don't agree with not participating with discussions with Republicans because they're Republicans. But this administration in the state of Florida has shown no effort to work with the Democrats, and I think the policies he's put forth are all pretty horrible. So anyway, we've not heard from them, but all the others, you and the four of the other guys, are participating in this roundtable, and I appreciate that. If people want to know more about you, they can go to your website. Spell it for us, because I don't have it up on the screen.
It's www. And it's my name, you know, Hava Holzhauer, which is... See the Hava, H-A-V-A.
Right.
Holzhauer is H-O-L, Z as in zebra, H-A-U-E-R. We can blame my husband for that name, for that very difficult name.
Gotcha.
.com.
Gotcha.
So it's now, my name, and they can find me that way.
And you're also on Twitter at Hava Holzhauer. And so Ted Deutch, you mentioned you decided to jump in when the day he made it official he's not running for re-election. Do you know Ted? Have you worked with him through the years? Or
I do know Ted. And we have a wonderful familial relationship, our families. We have children of similar ages, and we have, you know, had Shabbat dinners together over the years. And Ted and I would say, related to this job, we've spent a lot of time talking about Israel. Uh-huh. And talking about, you know, because I was at the ADL for a number of years and he was in Congress. And so that was an issue on both of our plates in different ways. And talking about anti-Semitism, which is the field that he is, you know, moving into very specifically.
Right.
Full time as he moves on to the AJC. So he's done an amazing job. You know, I talk to people all day in the district, and I appreciate, by the way, that you're having this program. Just to go back to the commentary you gave and relate it to this conversation about talking to donors. But that is all we can try to do as candidates. And to me, is the most important thing is to meet as many people as possible, to let them know who I am, to, you know, share information about me so that they can be making a decision that's not based on, you know, the mailers that are coming into the mailbox, but something that's a little bit more real and a little bit more close to the surface of what's going on. So I talk to people all day long, and a lot of love for Ted. Like, he has really, he's been in this seat for 12 years. He's Wow. done a great job for our community. I think he's been really responsive, at least to most of the people that I speak to in my experience and in knowing him. He has a huge heart. And, you know, I know that this is a very important seat. I also know that a woman has never held this seat.
Right.
I also know that 73% of the people in Congress are men. I also know that I am tired of men making decisions about my body and about our choices and about where we go. And if women's voices aren't represented in government and in Congress enough, we're not going to have the equality that we crave and that we need and that is a part of our humanity, you know, to propel us forward in the way that we, you know, deserve and, you know, the way that we should own as women. So I am really excited about being in this race and the opportunity to stand up and have an authentic voice that can speak, you know, to the women's issues, to the equality issues, and through this lens of justice.
Great. Well, we certainly need more women because our rights are, you know, being eroded. And not to say that the men aren't doing a good job, but hey, the more women in Congress right now, the better. Until we've We've achieved parity anyway. Have a whole hour. It's so nice to meet you. I'm sorry about the problem with the Chiron on the screen. I have gremlins in my studio from time to time, and they decided to attack today. But thank you. It was a pleasure meeting you.
Thanks for the opportunity. I appreciate the candor, and it was nice to have just an open conversation. So thank you so
always.
Much.
Anytime. And if you ever find the need to get something out to the people, let me know. You've got an open invitation here. It's nice to meet you. And thank you for stepping up and running. More than anything, that's what we need now, is people to step up for every office, not just Congress, mm-hmm. but the state houses. We need people. School boards, we need people. The right is taking it very seriously, and I'm afraid not enough of us are stepping up. So thank you for doing that.
I have to say that to what you just, that is one of the most important issues, is the down ticket, because when we ignore the down ticket and we only pay attention to the top, we are losing the ground even further under our feet.
We are sliding
off into the oblivion of more marginalization and more bad policies and more of the hate that's coming from the state of Florida. So you bring up a really important point, and thank you for thanking me. But, you know, I think everyone is jumping into this, and especially, you know, it is really difficult. It's a hard climb when you're non-establishment and you haven't been, you know, in office, and you don't have a ton of your own money to fund your own campaign. But all that being said, run. If you feel that you want to serve in this capacity anywhere along the continuum, there is no particular criteria. This is not a kingdom. This is not a place where someone gets knighted into the position. You run your A off, right?
Absolutely. Run for something. It. Yes. And Hava, before I let you go, a question. One question from the chat room. I think I know the answer, but I got to ask anyway. John asks, is Hava's husband related to James Holzhauer, the huge money winner on Jeopardy?
Okay. So I got to call my sister-in-law, Megan, because I think she did the research, and she says somewhere we are related, but we've never met. And we haven't had any holiday dinners together. But I will, you know, take it that, you know, that we're somehow related for sure. And
gotcha.
I'll find out from Megan.
All right. Well, thank you. It was great to meet you, and hopefully we'll meet again, and maybe I'll call you Congresswoman. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Thanks so
you
much.
Take care.
Good night.
Bye-bye. Have a house hour. Holzhauer, and the thing comes up again as I change this program. There's so many bugs in it, but hey, you know, it works most of the time anyway. All right, I've got Digby coming up, and I want to read to you this this editorial from the South Florida Sun Sentinel. You know what? Let me read it first. See, this is what happens when I'm multitasking. First of all, obviously, I'm having technical issues today. What else is new, right? But the other thing is, I got to get Digby's intro up here because it's not where it's supposed to be. And the stupid things I worry about here. The way I normally play it, she wouldn't be able to hear it anyway. So let's see if I've got it on this thing. Digby. Yeah, I do have it. Okay, so I got that. Got that going for us. All right, I'll tell you what. I'm going to start to read this op-ed, and this is where I get in trouble. While I'm reading it to you, I'm going to get Digby on the line. All right? So let me do that in the background. Let me bring her up. See, it stays like this. I really could use a producer, but, you know. It's not in the budget, and I don't have the workspace for him either. All right, so I'm going to call Digby, and you know what? Let me get her on the line, and then I will share the thing, I think. I don't know, and she's going to be on the phone today, so yeah, so there's that. Hey, Digby, it's Nicole calling. Oh, you know what? Wait, before I talk to you, let me do this.
What's that, Leonardo? Who's Nicole Sandler's next guest? Why, it's Digby, of course.
Of course.
Who's Digby? Observe, Leonardo. That's Dig for Dig and B for B. Digby.
Oh, man. Hey, Digby. I'm having...
I love that.
I do, too. But I'm having technical gremlins with my studio interface here. So as we talk, I'm getting this all, hopefully, in place and working correctly.
Okay.
So your picture... you're on the phone anyway, so you're not even seeing what's going on YouTube and the other streams. Okay. I think I got it. I love it when it works. All right. So... Yes, I have us both up with both names. I started doing this thing where I'm inviting all the candidates who are running for my open congressional seat, all the Democrats vying for the nomination, on the show so I get to know them. And I had this lovely woman on. Her name is Hava Holzhauer. Very nice, seems very qualified. She's a civil rights attorney, hasn't held elected office before. But I had a screw up with the Chyron, and the whole time we're talking, I couldn't get her name up there. So it's frustrating, you know, and I'm trying to listen to her out of one ear and do the busy work out of the other.
And it's, you know. That's the part I can't, you know, you guys who do this, I salute you because you are always working, you know, do it multitasking while you're on the air, which I find just amazing.
The multitasking is the hard part. And here's the other thing. You probably didn't see it because it's in a South Florida newspaper. But the South Florida Sun Sentinel, which is the paper really for Broward County, it's more Fort Lauderdale, Broward-centric than Miami or Palm Beach, but it covers all of it, has an editorial that is scathing for the guy up in Tallahassee that I want to share. So if you don't mind, I'm going to take a couple of minutes. So you should hear this. The headline reads, "Trump's grip weakens, but that's bad news for Florida." And again, this isn't a guest op-ed. This is the Sun Sentinel editorial board. And here's what they wrote. Ron DeSantis was Ron who? A backbencher in Congress with little hope of political stardom when Donald Trump enthusiastically endorsed him more than 4 years ago. One Trump tweet changed Florida history. And the tweet read, "Congressman Ron DeSantis is a brilliant young leader, Yale and then Harvard Law, who would make a great governor of Florida. He loves our country and is a true fighter." And like everything else out of Donald Trump's mouth, it's a lie. That's my commentary in there. Back to the op-ed, they write, "Now, as the ex-president sees DeSantis emerge as his biggest rival, Trump must have buyer's remorse. You can practically hear the dishware breaking at Mar-a-Lago. The recent and welcome news that Trump's grip is weakening with Republican voters also positions DeSantis as his strongest potential rival for the party's 2024 presidential nomination. That's bad news for the country. According to a New York Times Siena College poll, nearly half of Republican primary voters don't want Trump to run again. Florida's governor was their second choice at 25%, the only rival with more than 10% support, and the favorite among younger Republicans, those with college degrees and those who claimed to have voted for President Biden, not Trump." See, this should scare you.
Yeah.
A University of New Hampshire poll found Trump and DeSantis statistically tied in that first primary state. DeSantis continues to play coy, but his intentions are obvious. He's raising money out in Utah this week. He recently hosted a select, very private gathering of other Republican governors in Fort Lauderdale, the sort of thing that would-be presidents do. Some in the national media tout DeSantis as a wholesome and intelligent alternative to Trump. Others are alarmed. Be alarmed. Quote, "Just because DeSantis is smarter than Trump doesn't mean that he's any less dangerous. In fact, he might be an even bigger threat for that very reason," wrote columnist Max Boot in the Washington Post. That's right. Anyone who admires DeSantis from afar should come to Florida with eyes wide open. After winning by just 32,463 votes, he has governed with total contempt toward the 4 million people who didn't vote for him. He's as authoritarian as Trump, just as disdainful of democracy, no less polarizing, and openly hostile to scientific evidence that doesn't conform to his narrow agenda. Although DeSantis didn't endorse Trump's big lie of a stolen election, he's not willing to refute it, and he still won't say whether Biden was fairly elected. He has scorned the House committee's brilliant investigation into Trump's attempted coup. And it continues. It says DeSantis is a bully. No Florida governor has been as ruthless or effective in dominating his state, owning the legislature, and trampling dissent. The governor, who boasts of empowering parents, mocked school kids in his presence for wearing masks to protect themselves against the coronavirus, as their parents had told them. Calibrating his political appeal to voters who put selfishness over social responsibility, DeSantis appointed a quack physician to run the health department. The quack refused to order vaccines for children under age 5 and intends to deny gender dysphoria treatment to young people who depend on Medicaid. DeSantis and his drones in the legislature ruthlessly put down school boards and local governments that sought to save lives with masks, vaccines, and social distancing requirements. It's terrifying to contemplate DeSantis in the Oval Office when the next pandemic inevitably comes along. You know, Dibby, I keep thinking I'll cut it off here and let everybody read the rest online. But then I look at the next line and it says, when Nazis picketed at Orlando, he was silent. Exploiting society's vulnerability to cultural warfare, DeSantis has prohibited schools, colleges, and even private businesses from dealing honestly with racism and its ugly history. His law labeled Don't Say Gay by critics openly caters to homophobia, chilling sex education in schools, and putting students at risk of being outed to their parents. For Disney World's mild opposition, DeSantis got the legislature to repeal its taxing district, putting the company at risk and threatening to bankrupt two counties that might inherit Disney's debts. Sorry, he carried his culture warfare into the selection of public school textbooks. A new civics training course for teachers maintains that the founders did not intend to separate church and state, which is grossly false. You see why I'm so freaked out about this guy. Continues, when the legislature tried to honor the Fair Districts Amendment to Florida's Constitution, DeSantis demanded and got a ruthless congressional gerrymander calculated to replace two black Democrats with white Republicans. He signed a 15-week abortion ban that openly flouts Florida's constitutional right to privacy, secure in the belief that a Supreme Court turned flagrantly reactionary by his opponents will be just as contemptuous of the Constitution. He has boasted of packing the appellate branch with fellow ideologues from the Federalist Society. All right, you know what? I am going to stop here. There's not much more, but it goes on like that. This guy is truly dangerous, and his national poll ratings are on the rise. Do you have any, Digby? You do so much work, getting the pulse of the nation. Why do people embrace this guy? He's worse than Trump.
Oh, he's way, way worse than Trump. And I write about him a lot. And I'm out here in California, so I'm not in the middle of it like you are.
Right.
So I don't have, you know, that feeling of being, you know, sort of overwhelmed by what this guy is doing. But I read a lot about him, and I follow him very, very closely for
Good.
All the reasons
Thank you.
That you just laid out. This guy, I used to call him Trump 2.0, and that was my nickname for him when I wrote about him on my blog. I've stopped doing that because I realized something recently. He is not Trump 2.0. He's a whole different level. He's a whole different program is what he is. Now, there's a big difference between the two, and I just want to say that before I answer your question, which is Donald Trump, you know, he wields power over the base of the Republican Party. But it's purely a personal relationship, and everything about politics is personal to him. Someone is disloyal to him personally, he lashes out and goes after them personally and by name on social media or wherever. We've all seen this happen 1,000 times. That's the source of his power, is that he's very, very hands-on, one-on-one, and everything he does is to advance his own personal power. He has no program. You know, at most, it's, you know, gee, we don't like immigrants and, you know, the usual.
Right.
You know, law and order, you know, whatever he says from one day to the next, there's no consistency. DeSantis is a whole different animal because he has adopted much of the style of Trump in the sense that he's a bully. He's very, very aggressive, but he's much, much more strategic. And he is not doing it solely for the benefit of Ron DeSantis. He's doing it for the benefit of a full-scale authoritarian program that he believes in and that he believes he can make, he can actually enact and use in this country. The person that he is most like is not even an American. He's Hungarian, and it's a guy named Viktor Orban, who is the prime minister of, or the president of Hungary.
Right.
And this is, you know, this is the authoritarian model that DeSantis is using. And when you watch him, it's amazing because he's very good. I mean, I agree with you. He was just some backbench nobody Tea Party freak. You know?
Right.
I mean,
he was not supposed,
supposed
to be the governor. There was a guy, Adam Putnam, I think, in Florida politics. He was working his way up through the Republican Party in the state system. He was the next in line. And, you know, that's how they often do it. And then Trump brings this guy off the backbench.
Yeah.
I had never even heard of him before. And
I had only heard of him in that he was one of the Freedom Caucus guys, right? So his name would turn up on all this nutty stuff. So to me, he was fringe. He was as fringe as it gets. And the fact that he won, as you point out, by very, very few votes in your big state, it was an extremely close election. And he won and then just ran with this. And, you know, you look at the guy and you realize after watching the way that he's doing this, he's become a super culture warrior, right? I mean, I call him a commandante in the culture wars. But he's doing it a little differently than others are, right? I mean, he is not going full-blown, you know, Christian right type. He's danced around, well, the abortion issue. You know, they did the 15-week abortion ban in anticipation, and after that, he's been very, very quiet. He does not want to jump into that one, understanding that it's becoming a third rail, and he's staying away from that. He's also has been very unusually dodgy about same-sex marriage, which now is becoming another big issue. And of course, you know, on the books in Florida is still the ban against same-sex marriage. They've never taken it off the books. So if perchance this Supreme Court were to overturn it, it could just very easily, without any effort, go back to that. And, you know, you have a whole new fight on your hands. That doesn't mean that he is not going after the LGBT issue with everything he's got. He's just coming at it from a different direction, and he's very, very smart in the way he's doing this. He's plucking at all these strands about, you know, trans rights and trans children and public education, which Republicans hate. All those things are hugely popular, you know, sort of aggressive tactics with the base. And everybody else is kind of confused by it. Whereas gay marriage and abortion, people are pretty well solid in their belief system on that. They're not really dodgy, although gay marriage is still very unpopular among the far right, among the base of the Republican Party. I don't think people really realize that. You know, that the Christian right and the evangelical, conservative evangelicals are still against gay marriage, so nobody should feel too confident that this isn't going to be a big battle to come.
Right.
But you see DeSantis working these issues, and he's working them in a different way than others are. He's following these fringy ideas, you know, anti-critical race theory and, you know, family
drag shows
and all this crazy stuff, right? And the base loves it. I mean, the Republicans love it. I mean, they're almost, you know, falling more in love with Ron than with Don.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, but so, yeah, I mean, why do people like him? He's younger. He's, you know, the Trump whining, I think, is getting tired. DeSantis is not a whiner like Trump is. He has a whole different approach.
He is a nasty, vindictive, ugly man. He's really mean.
Mean-spirited. But they like that.
Yeah, they do. This Trump.
That's what they like about both of them. I mean, that's their favorite thing about Trump and DeSantis, is the fact that he is mean and he goes after people, anybody who's vulnerable. That makes, I don't know, that, I guess that makes these kind of people feel strong or something.
I guess.
You know, the sort of excitement people are starting to sense around DeSantis is kind of, I think, the idea of moving into the post-Trump world. Now, that doesn't mean, and I just want to point this out, you know, everybody said, well, you know, maybe Trump's done and people are getting tired of him. Yeah, well, good luck with that. Because Trump still has at least at least 40% and probably more of the Republican Party absolutely adore him and worship him. That's not going to go away right away, and it's not going away. Some Republicans are kind of going, again, do we have to do this? You know, but let me tell you, the minute that DeSantis or anybody else enters the race against Donald Trump will savage them with everything that they have. Anybody who thinks, and if Ron DeSantis were to win the nomination, let me just ask you what you think. Any chance you think that Donald Trump will gracefully concede and just walk away and endorse him? I mean, does that sound like our Trump?
No.
I don't think
so.
You don't even want to think about what kind of a mess there will be, which comes to my belief that Donald Trump, if he is alive and he wants the nomination for 2024, I think he has it, because I don't think nobody doesn't recognize that guy will make an absolute mess out of that election if he doesn't win, right?
Wow.
I mean, that's just the way he is. So maybe they're all thinking that he'll keel over. I mean, that's possible. He's an older guy. I mean, he could easily keel over.
Are there stairs? Are there stairs at Mar-a-Lago that he might fall down?
I doubt it. I'm sure he's had those taken out. And ramps aren't any better for that guy either. You know,
he's got kind of issues with that too. Yes, he does.
You know, so anyway, I just think that you know, it's super interesting to me, because what we see with Ron DeSantis is the next generation of the Republican Party, and it's worse than the current current generation in many, many ways, because I think it will be much more efficient, and I think there's a program underlying it that I don't think it's this white nationalist / populist thing that's going on in a lot of places around the world. We're not the only ones who are going through this. It exists in Europe, all over the place, specifically in Hungary. And hey, you want to look at Russia.
Yeah.
You know, they all like that guy too. So, you know, this is a model.
Yeah.
He's a bully.
Yeah, he is. Right. Bullies, I guess, are in fashion.
I guess so.
You know, I happen to like people who aren't bullies. I think that's a sort of kind of a weird Trump quote in a way. Anyway, so Digby, you know, there's so much. You at your blog, digbysblog.net is how you get to the new site. It's Digby's Hullabaloo. It's a constant turning over of information. And when I invited you to come back on the show a few days ago, the piece I had just read of yours was about the media and the way the media is trying to be, you know, be fair. I hate to use the term fair and balanced. And because they were so tough on Trump, they were like chomping at the bit to, you know, to do the both sider thing to Joe Biden. And maybe they've been a bit too harsh. I don't know. I think there's times that Joe Biden deserves criticism. I feel the ire of listeners sometimes when I'm critical, but I'm critical because I care, because I want him to do better. And so I think that's my job. But there are sometimes the media goes a bit too far. Where do you fall on this? Do you think that Biden's plummeting approval ratings are because of the media treatment of him, or do you think they've been unfair to him?
Well, I do think they've been unfair to him, and I think it's because of what you said in the beginning. There was, and I predicted it. I predicted it months and months before the election in 2020. I said everybody needs to get ready, because the media is going to be under tremendous pressure, much of it self-imposed, to even the score. Because they were very, very hard on Trump, and they are very sensitive to the idea that they're that they're being partisan or biased, and they will be also subject to a ton of criticism from the right, and as they were when Trump was in office as well. And you're going to see an effort on their part to ensure that they, are as tough on Joe Biden as they were on Donald Trump. Now, it's not as easy to be as tough on Joe Biden, because he just isn't as much of a train wreck as Donald Trump was. But nonetheless, these are very tough times with a lot of very big, difficult issues. And I was, you know, when I wrote the piece on my blog, I was riffing off of a piece by Perry Bacon in the Washington Post, who made this point, and it's a very good piece and one well worth reading, in which he cites a lot of data. Perry Bacon's a data guy, right? In fact, he used to write with 538. So he did a lot of research for this piece to sort of look at how the polling numbers have tracked with some, you know, very, very sharp and, in my view, unfair criticism, and I think unfair criticism in his view as well. Most specifically, going back to the Afghanistan withdrawal, that's when Biden's numbers started to plummet. And the coverage of that I found to be just astonishingly bad. It was just egregious. I mean, they were acting as though, you know, Biden had, you know, just committed a terrible crime by, you know, fulfilling his promise to withdraw from Afghanistan.
To do what we've been asking to be done for 20 years.
Even Donald Trump was saying he was going to do it. I mean, my God, you know, and Biden actually took that hit. And it was a massive hit. And it was the beginning of his decline. And it was a sharp decline. Nothing has been sharper than that. That was the thing that did it. And when you look at the coverage of that, it was really, really poor. They went crazy. You could see that, you know, there's something you sense if you watch a lot of news like you and I do, and I'm sure some of your listeners do as well, if you're a political junkie and you watch a lot of this stuff and read a lot of the commentary. There's a sense of, you know, there's a kind of a pile on that starts to happen when certain events take place. And I could feel it at the time, and I knew it was going to happen, which was, oh, here we go. They have got, you know, they smell blood in the water, and they're going for it. And so, you know, you see the way that they cover things, like, for instance, gas prices, right?
Yeah.
You know, or inflation, generally speaking. There's very little context.
None.
But it's a bunch of interviews down at gas stations with people screaming about gas prices.
Do they ever point out the prices of gas in the rest of the world?
Exactly.
Because ours is immeasurably lower, even at the elevated rate it is. We're still paying half of what they're paying in the rest of the world.
Right. And they ask these stupid leading questions like, should you know, Joe Biden be, you know, okaying more drilling in the Gulf of Mexico?
Oh, God.
And you're going, how's that going to fix our gas prices?
Right.
Could you please make it explicit that that is not happening? Or even just today, they're talking about climate change. And, you know, so Biden, you know, I mean, he just got, you know, screwed over once again by Joe Manchin.
Hello.
We all did. The whole world did.
Yep.
And, you know, but here they are, you know, kind of, you know, pounding Biden. He gave a speech, you know, he said, we're in a terrible state, you know, it's an existential crisis, blah, blah, blah. He's going to do some things. They're screaming at him for not, you know, declaring a state of emergency.
Right.
And, you know, so you're going, okay, maybe, is that right? Should he declare a state of emergency? And you go and look into it and you find out it's a meaningless thing. It's just, it's more or less rhetorical. And he, you know, it has no bearing on the actual policies that he is putting in place to the extent he can as president, which is not nothing, but it's certainly not as good as, you know, the climate legislation that they'd been working on for months and months and months to appease Joe Biden, to appease Joe Manchin, and then just, you know, blew it all up for no good reason.
Again.
You know, they're blaming him somehow for being, you know, inept on climate change. So I'm not saying that in any way, just let me be clear. Of course, Joe Biden is subject to criticism, and I have a lot of criticism.
Yes.
I mean, you know, and I think you and I are on the same page
with this,
and probably most of your listeners, that, you know, this sort of, you know, hey, I get along with everybody in the Senate, and, you know, we can work together, and, you know, I understand how these things work, and I can make the trains run on time because I've been around a long time. That did not work out, and in fact, it's been very, very, very destructive in many ways, and so I think we agree that Biden is, in many ways, a man out of time. And I think we kind of knew that, didn't we?
We did. Look.
I mean, I can't say that I'm sitting here surprised that he's not a... And in fact, I was very surprised in the beginning that he was as bold as he was.
Me and
me
both.
Going for it. But, you know, in the end, he's sort of reverted to the Joe Biden that, you know, we always knew when he has his good points and his bad points. I mean, he's better than Trump, but
without
you know,
a doubt.
Whatever.
But that's not enough. It's like you know, the Democrats running on, and I had a whole thing the other night. I'm thinking, okay, here's the campaign for the Democrats. We know we haven't been able to come through on all the things we said we would do. We know we've been ineffective and somewhat you know, less than capable of doing things, but we're so much better than the other guys. Look at what they've done. Just, you know, so you got to vote for us because at least we mean well.
Yeah. I know. It's right? tough, you know, and it's not wrong in a lot of ways, right?
I know.
I mean, but, you know, I have to admit that, I mean, to me, well, and let me just give an example of something I think that's actually pretty smart that we're seeing them do right this week.
Okay.
Which is, you know, they brought up this, they're bringing up legislation and making Republicans vote on
things on the record
that they don't want to vote for.
That's right.
Wow. And this is not, these aren't messaging votes that, like they usually do, which is, you know, that's, you know, and I'll use codifying Roe as one of them, right?
Yes.
Not that I say that shouldn't be done, but the utility of that as a messaging bill is useless because everybody knows the Republicans are, you know, quote, pro-life. And
yeah.
that is not going to tell anybody anything they don't know. Same-sex marriage? Whoa.
Yep. Yep.
Did everybody
know
that 157 Republicans were going to vote against it? I don't think people knew that.
That's right.
I don't think people understand how hostile so much of the Republican Party still is to gay marriage.
That's right.
I don't think people understand that contraception is, it actually is going to be on the agenda, you know, banning contraception or curtailing the use of contraception. These are the kind of messaging bills that really can bite. And I thought, whoa, you know, the Democrats are actually, you know, somebody
right.
on Twitter, I don't remember who it was, says, hey, it looks like we got some politicking going on here. You know, I'm going,
thank goodness.
Wow.
Thank goodness. Because, look, we've got, you know, the Senate race. Anything can happen. Look, somebody wrote to me the other day, a listener said, would you agree that the Supreme Court overturning Roe is the best thing that could have happened for the Democrats? I'm like, no, I don't agree. Are you fucking kidding me? No. But that said, no, we don't want Roe overturned. Women should have a right to decide what happens with our bodies. However, this might be the dumbest thing the Republicans have done because it's going to give a lot of Republicans reason to vote against the Republicans because they see our rights being taken away from us.
Yeah.
All this stuff because this is overreach. So good. Let them keep overreaching. But no, it's not a good thing.
Oh, it's terrible. It's the worst thing that we can imagine.
That's right.
I mean, it was our worst nightmare. And, you know, and the reason that we know, however, that on some level they understand that this is going to be a problem, as I said earlier, DeSantis obviously sees it as some kind of a third rail,
mm-hmm.
is the way that they're acting about it. They're all saying, hey, don't worry, ladies, you can still get your abortions. It won't be that bad. And they're
right.
even saying, oh, no, that doesn't count as an abortion. You know, you're going, what are you talking about? You know, you can't run away from what you've done. You people were out there saying that this is murder. Life begins at conception. You got your people all riled up for personhood bills and things. And you didn't even consider what the consequences of that might be. And I'm not just talking about the politics, which are obvious. The actual consequences for real live human beings here. You've got, you know, people who are unable to get, you know, the medication that they need to deal with their chronic illnesses because those medications are used for medical abortions from time to time.
It's amazing.
They can't get, you know, they're talking about ectopic pregnancies,
yes.
letting women just suffer on the operating table.
And bleed out,
you know,
and die.
And go around.
You will die from an ectopic pregnancy.
Yeah, and will die. Yeah, I mean, and of course, the incredible story about the 10-year-old rape victim that had to travel to go get an abortion and the way that they acted about it. I mean, this is a horror story for actual human beings, people, their own, you know, wives, mothers, daughters, you know, everybody. And you know, they have to live with what they've done, you know, and they did it by creating this incredible movement of people who are absolute fanatics. They're zealots. They
yes.
are, they have no, you know, they have absolutely no sort of, you know, sense of compromise or any kind of ability to see this as anything. They call it a Holocaust. They call it, you know, they say that they compare it to the Holocaust, abortion. So, you know, they
Amazing.
Did this and they got their way and now they're going to have to live with it. And we're going to see this on a whole bunch of issues. So we're going to have it out. There's going to be, you know, they want this culture war and we didn't want it.
No.
You know, we didn't ask for it.
But they brought it, so bring it on. Because, it, frankly, in the end, it is the only thing that I think can save the Democrats at this point. But they've got to be loud about it. Look at what they're doing. Spell it out every damn day.
Well, let me ask you something. I'd love to get your opinion on this.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's been a big thing this week about everybody saying the Democrats shouldn't be doing, you know, advertising in Republican primaries so that they can run against crazy people.
To boost
right?
the mean, craziest of the crazies.
Right,
and yes,
the craziest.
So,
like Doug Mastriano or the guy in Maryland.
The guy in Maryland. So I wanted, we're going to go into overtime. Sorry, Progressive Voices.
Sorry.
No, it's good. I hope you have a couple minutes to stick around because there's so much to talk to you about, Digby. So I'm just letting Progressive Voices know we're going to run a little long today. So Maryland had their primary yesterday. Now, you know, Howie Klein is on the show every Thursday. He's going to be off the next couple of weeks. But every Thursday, and we talk about Blue America all the time. Some of the listeners may not know that you and John Amato from Crooks and Liars are also part of Blue America with Howie.
Right.
So, what? Pennsylvania. I don't know. Mastriano, Pennsylvania. Yeah. I don't even know what I said. Now I lost my train of thought. In Maryland, what happened was, first of all, Donna Edwards did not win her primary because of money spent by these pro AIPAC groups, including the one that Hakeem Jeffries is part of. And that's a whole other thing that we can talk about another day. But the Democrats also boosted this guy who won the primary in the gubernatorial race for the Republicans because he's crazier. He was Donald Trump's choice as opposed to Hogan's choice, the current governor. And it kind of elevated him, just like Mastriano in Pennsylvania and some others. I think it's counterproductive. I think the Democrats need to concentrate on their own races and let the Republicans put up whoever they're going to put up.
Well, I don't disagree with that. I think they can spend the money better than that, probably. But I don't think it made any difference.
No?
I think Mastriano was going to win anyway, and so is this guy Cox. Now, Mastriano in Pennsylvania is more of a problem because Pennsylvania is a swing state. And,
right.
you know, you don't know how they're going to go. Turnout is going to be hugely important. It's going to be a big thing. And if you look at the ads that they put out against, you know, quote, boosting Mastriano, they were an ad you could run in a general election. I mean, they weren't saying Mastriano's a good guy. You really
no, they were saying he's the most
terrific.
Extreme.
You like thing. He's a nutball.
Right.
And he's completely out of his mind. And, of course, that's what Republican voters love. I don't think it would have made any difference. He was way ahead of that big crowd anyway. And by the way, the other people who were running against him were just as bad. Really.
Right.
I mean, he's way out there.
I hear you.
They're just as bad, but they're close.
But
now
but
Maryland
like,
is a different
okay.
story
yeah.
because Maryland, you know, Biden won Maryland by 30 points, and Maryland is not going to vote for this guy Cox. I mean, if that happens, then, you know, the world has stopped spinning, and, you know, we really need to reevaluate everything. That's a blue state that's not going to do it. Hogan won by being about as moderate a Republican as you can get.
Right.
And they you know, they kind of, like Massachusetts, of all things, votes for Republican governors.
Which is weird.
All the time.
Right.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, there's some states that do that, but they don't vote for nutcases.
Right.
And that's what this guy
Cox
is. So I think they're going to have a Democratic governor. And just to, you know, top that out, to talk about Edwards, that's kind of a heartbreaker to me.
It really is.
Don Edwards is great, and I am really sorry. I mean, I don't know, maybe the guy that beat her will be good. I mean, he's going to win. It's a Democratic district.
Right.
And maybe he'll be fine. But, you know, it's just, it's heartbreaking to see that kind of, you know, I don't know. They spent $7 million
against
to take her down.
In a primary, in a Democratic primary. In one district, and she's not a raging progressive.
She's not, and on the issue that they're concerned with, it has to do with Israel. She's not even a raging, you know, anti-Israel.
Right.
Person.
She's not.
You know,
she's very.
Why her? I mean, there are some people for whom that issue is just front and center, super important. I mean, I don't agree, but I could see why they would target her. But yeah. Why Donna? You know,
I don't get it.
Anyway, that was very disappointing, and I was sorry to see that. And, you know, that's an issue that the Democrats are going to have to, it's one of those internal issues that they're going to have to address here, because
it's
starting to become very destructive, I think.
I agree.
People are not liking it, because that's not... You know, that
it's,
just doesn't,
it's not constructive.
Doesn't really work in today's Democratic
right.
coalition.
It's
it
a
needs
negative
to be a little subtler than
thing.
That.
I agree. But so on sort of the flip side of that, let me ask you about this. Tim Ryan was never my favorite congressman from Ohio or anywhere. He wasn't my first choice to be the nominee to run for the Senate as a Democrat from Ohio. But he knows how to get up and make a fiery speech and make noise. But what he's doing now is he's portraying himself as an independent and touting that he has the support of Maria Bartiromo and Tucker Carlson? What the hell?
I don't know what to say to that. You know, I also heard him say today that he's, you know, he's plans to, you know, he'll be the, you know, the yang to Sherrod Brown's yang.
Oh,
you know,
my
they're
God.
They're going to work together and be a, you know, a pair. I don't know what to say about it. I mean, they all do these polling and focus groups, and somehow he thinks he can compete with J.D. Vance, I guess, for the Tucker Carlson vote. That just doesn't ring true to me. But, you know, we'll see what happens. But I'm with you on Tim Ryan. He's never been somebody. I mean, I appreciate it when he stands up and gives one of these,
yep.
you know,
fiery
you know,
speeches.
Wild speeches yep. of his, you know, this, and he waves his hands around and, you know, says something I enjoy hearing. But, you know, that's not the be-all and end-all. And we are going to find that he is not going – I don't think he's going to vote like Sherrod Brown.
No.
I would be very surprised if he does that, because he never has.
Right.
And he was – you know, I mean, maybe he'll see the light. I mean, he's not the worst. I mean, he's better – again, here we are again. Better than J.D. Vance.
Exactly.
I mean, the fact that we even have to say that – that J.D. Vance, of all people, is actually, you know, a nominee. And the good news is that he's actually not performing very well, apparently.
Right. That's what
you know,
I hear.
From what I'm reading. So maybe we'll have Ryan in there. And you know what? He'll be a pain in the ass just like
he'll
Joe
Manchin. He'll be a
Manchin
Joe Manchin.
Because those
right.
guys always are.
That's
they
right.
always are. You know, there's nothing new about this. But, you know, there's always, remember Joe Lieberman, the previous
Joe? How can we forget Joe?
You know, I mean, there's always a Joe in there that are pains in the asses, and I guess, and Tim Ryan will be one of them, I guarantee it. You know, just be, they and both parties have them, you know, there's Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski uh-huh. and, you know, Mitt Romney, who we appreciate on our side, the same way that they appreciate Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Lieberman and all those guys uh-huh. on their side. But, you know, in this evenly divided country that we have, where you have these super slim majorities, it is a recipe for gridlock and absolute, you know, just total disappointment. And, you know, this is going to be a problem, I think. I mean, hopefully they can, you know, the Democrats, there is a chance, and it's looking like it's, you know, better than we thought, that they might be able to keep the Senate
yeah.
and maybe pick up a seat or two. But don't get your hopes up, because it's going to be people like Tim Ryan.
I know. That's the problem.
So
if you're thinking, we need two
get
more.
Rid of the Senate altogether.
Right.
We don't need it.
Please. Or at least make it, you know, proportional representation of the population. The thing that kills me about the Senate is that South Dakota has the same
yeah.
pull in the Senate as California does. It's just flat out wrong. So, but
yeah.
that's topic for another day too. Digby, there's so much I could talk to you about. And tomorrow is we're told it will not be the final hearing
no.
from the January 6th committee, just the final one for this. It's the season
series,
finale.
They're calling it,
it's
yeah.
the season finale, but the series
right.
isn't over yet. Right. So, we'll have the popcorn ready tomorrow night. And Friday,
absolutely.
All I'm going to do is
I'm
go through
it. Already.
You and me both. Digby, thank you so much. There's so many more things. I'll just have to save some for the next time, because there's always
okay.
overflow. Thank you. Everybody, find Digby, of course, Digby56 on Twitter and digbysblog.net, which is where you get hullabaloo these days. Thank you, as always.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
Always my pleasure. Thank you so much. Bye-bye. Digby, everybody, she just is the best. I know somebody, it seemed like somebody, I glanced over in the chat room, you know, on a show like today, when, first of all, when I'm having, you know, trouble with the gremlins in the studio, but when I have two live guests, I really can't follow the chat. And the chat regulars know I do my best to keep up with what's going on in there. Today, I just couldn't. But I did glance over and I saw somebody say, wow, I like her. This woman's pretty spot on. She is. Digby is one of the OG progressive bloggers. She's old guard, you know, royalty. So I'm always honored for Digby's appearance on the show. All right. There's a lot more. But you know what? Tomorrow we're going to hear from two more of the Florida candidates. Howie will not be here. But I'll have time to go through some stuff that's been piling up because I haven't had a chance to share it with you. We can take phone calls. We can prepare for tomorrow night. And then Friday is going to be all about what happens tomorrow night. And you're more than welcome to weigh in on that. And what else? I don't know. There's all kinds of stuff, but I guess we'll save it for another day. As always, thank you for listening. Thanks to Hava Holzhauer. She's not Holzhauer. She's Holzhauer. Again, I'll put links to all of her stuff on the blog where I post the show today. It'll be at NicoleSandler.com/7-20-22. That's how I post the shows, with the NicoleSandler.com/ and the date in that format. So I did glance over, though, at the chat room and saw that I'm having trouble with my links. Jan says... I love this. Jan Morgan says, just tell your webmaster to get their links straight and test, Nicole. I'm the webmaster. I do everything. I don't have people. So if I screw something up, it's my screw up. I can't pass the buck to anyone else. If you can't donate to the show using the PayPal link, there are others. There's Buy Me a Cup of Coffee. There's Stripe on there. There's Patreon. There are a lot of ways to donate, but I will check out the, I guess, a broken PayPal donation link. But thank you for trying, because I do survive on your donations. That's how this show is funded. I don't run commercials, and it's, you know, and I don't have a paywall. So any support you can give is greatly appreciated. All right. With that, I will leave you with the news until we see each other again tomorrow. Actually, you see me. I don't see you, as far as you know. All right. I'll talk to you tomorrow. Thanks, everybody. Have a good night.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
On Tuesday, 47 Republicans joined with all the House Democrats who voted to pass a bill to protect marriage equality. The bill, an effort to counter the right-wing extreme court, would repeal the 1996 Defense of Marriage Act, codify protections for same-sex marriage into federal law, and also would include federal protections for interracial marriages. So although it passed in the House, it's still not clear whether the bill can pass the Senate, where at least 10 Republicans would need to join with every Democrat to overcome the nonsensical filibuster's 60-vote threshold. And if you thought same-sex marriage was already legal, well, beginning with the then Supreme Court's 2013 decision in Windsor versus United States, the court began to strike down any restrictions against same-sex marriage. And in that 2013 ruling, the court invalidated a key provision of the Defense of Marriage Act, allowing same-sex couples to be treated as married for all federal tax purposes, as long as they were legally married in a state that recognized their marriage. Then the court went further in 2015 in Obergefell versus Hodges, the decision that said same-sex couples have the right to marry in all states. But the recent ruling in Dobbs by this very right-wing new extreme court that reversed Roe v. Wade, in his concurring opinion, Justice Clarence Thomas suggested the bench, quote, should reconsider all of this court's substantive due process precedents, including Obergefell. So the Respect for Marriage Act would also shore up protections for interracial marriage. That is a constitutional right established in the court's Loving versus Virginia ruling, which obviously includes Clarence Thomas's marriage to his white wife. You'll notice that Thomas did not list the rights for interracial couples to marry in his concurring opinion. Gee, I wonder why. He did, however, explicitly mention Lawrence and Griswold, which dealt with same-sex intimate relationships and contraceptive access as well. So today, the House is scheduled to vote on the Right to Contraception Act, which would protect a person's ability to access contraceptives and to engage in contraception and to protect a healthcare provider's ability to provide contraceptive services. This, too, will most likely pass in the House, but there are questions about the Senate. Just amazing. More than a dozen Democratic congresswomen were arrested during an abortion rights protest outside the Extreme Court yesterday. Those taken into custody include Representatives Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, Ayanna Pressley, and 14 others. So Congress has a lot on its plate. They're trying to jam in as much as they can in the remaining days before they break for the August recess to go home and campaign for the November elections. The House Judiciary Committee is marking up legislation to ban assault weapons today, but the Democratic leaders aren't even sure they have enough votes to pass it through the full House. Speaker Nancy Pelosi only has a 4-vote margin right now and 2 definite no's. Representatives Jared Golden of Maine and Henry Cuellar of Texas. You may recall Nancy Pelosi going to his district to campaign for this man, probably the most conservative House Democrat, and recently was the only Democrat to vote against the Women's Health Protection Act. And you wonder why we can't have nice things. By the way, there are 2 other likely Democratic no's. One is Kurt Schrader, who thankfully was defeated by a progressive in his primary in Oregon, so he will not be back in January. And Ron Kind of Wisconsin, just saying. Things are moving in Georgia, where prosecutors are getting closer to possible criminal charges against those involved in the former guy's scheme to use fake electors. You know the story. In an attempt to overturn the 2020 presidential election, Trump campaign officials tried to subvert the Electoral College process by installing their own fake Republican electors in 7 states. These Trump backers then signed fake certificates proclaiming their votes for president and vice president. Court documents filed late Tuesday revealed all 16 of those individuals who signed those unofficial certificates in Georgia may be indicted in this probe. And aside from that, multiple concerns are being raised about Trump's 24 Secret Service members and their actions on January 6th. The DHS Inspector General had requested a month's worth of records from the Secret Service so they could get a closer look at Trump's actions and behavior during the time of the insurrection. But the Secret Service has only produced 1 single text exchange, claiming a technical snafu when they changed their phones. Just incredible. From the Elections Have Consequences file, Tuesday was primary day in only 1 state, Maryland, and the outcome, well, wasn't great. The Trump-endorsed far-right candidate for the Republican gubernatorial nomination won in a hotly contested Democratic primary for a House seat in Washington's Maryland suburbs.
And that's just a bit of what's new.
Former prosecutor Glenn Ivey,
who was
backed
by...
If you appreciate these
reports, whoops.
Uh-oh. Super PACs,
sorry.
Democrats,
uh-oh.
100% spent heavily on his behalf,
beat
former Congresswoman
Donna
Edwards. And United Democracy Project, which is aligned
okay,
with
that's
a
done.
PAC, spent about $6 million to elect Ivey.
Or we should say, to beat Edwards. And Democratic Majority for Israel spent more than $425,000 to the same end.
This is all a direct result of Citizens United, in case you were wondering. Ukraine's First Lady, Olena Zelenska, is in the U.S. and she'll deliver remarks to Congress this morning. On Monday, the First Lady of Ukraine met with Secretary of State Antony Blinken and accepted the Dissident Human Rights Award on behalf of the people of Ukraine. Her speech today is open to all members of the House and Senate. And yes, it's hot out there. And it's not only here. A heat wave ravaging Europe has brought temperatures of over 104 degrees to the UK, shattering their record for the highest temperature ever recorded. Before Tuesday, Britain's record high was 101.7, set back in 2019.
This heat wave has fueled wildfires from Portugal to the Balkans and caused hundreds of heat-related deaths. The chief scientist at Britain's Met Office weather agency, Stephen Belcher, said such extreme temperatures would be virtually impossible without climate change, and he warned that similar heat waves could hit Europe every 3 years if there are no big carbon emission cuts. Today, President Biden travels to Massachusetts, where he'll announce new steps to combat climate change. But he will reportedly stop short of issuing an emergency declaration that would unlock federal resources to deal with the issue.
Come on, man.
And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.